History of Macedonian Kings. Alexander the Great. Alexander plans to move on. Part 1. Everything suggests that from the beginning, Alexander had planned to add territory in Asia to his kingdom and not lead merely a punitive raid. The negotiations with Darius and his refusal of successive offers includes all the land west of the Euphrates shows his ambitions were grand. If he left a Persian king, whoever it was, at the head of a sizable kingdom, then the probability was that the war would be renewed at some point in the future, just as he is said to have told his soldiers. Thus, conquest of any new territory required the destruction of the Persian Empire to make these gains secure in the long term. Alexander probably understood this from the start, for the logic is simple enough and ought to be clear to his officers as well. The difficulty lay in achieving this goal, not in the idea itself, and once again we need to remind ourselves just how spectacular and rapid the war had been. Alexander may have dreamed of such success and was young and self-regarding enough to expect it, but nothing in recent nor even more distant history foreshadowed it. Any sensible person would have expected a far longer war, perhaps with intervals of negotiated peace before the conflict was renewed, much like Philip's campaigns, which in their day had surprised observers by their speed. Alexander had forced the pace of the war, suffered no truly serious setbacks, and won, which does not mean that it had been easy. Throughout all of this, much of his mind and energy was absorbed in fighting the war itself, and this was surely even more true of the rest of the army. Planning for the after victory could wait until that victory had been won. Region by region, he appointed satraps, military and financial commanders, including friendly dynasts and factions in Asia Minor, and enlisted locals in Egypt and then provinces in the heart of his empire, all of it on an ad hoc basis. This was far from being a formal and permanent system of government for the vastly enlarged kingdom he was creating, not the least because as yet he didn't know what he was creating, and pauses were rare before moving on the next offensive. Money was no longer a problem, that's for sure, and unlike Philip, who had spent much of each windfall on ongoing diplomacy and the next war, Alexander was no longer faced with any real financial restrictions on what he wanted to do. Indeed, from now on, the only aspect requiring thought was moving wealth to where it was needed. The sums acquired were so great that waste and corruption didn't matter. Alexander was also notably generous in gifts, especially to his companions, and set an example in extravagance. We read of one officer who used silver hobnails on his boots and another who had sand brought all the way from Egypt for his wrestling practice. The prizes for bravery grew in proportion to the spoils, but all shared in the gains just as they'd all shared in the toil, as was proper for the Macedonians. The bulk of the army expected to go home when the war was complete. Presumably few, at least of the officers, thought that would entirely withdraw and abandon all the lands they had taken. Panhellenus had spoken of bringing peace to Greece by letting Greeks live from the produce of estates worked on by conquered Asians, and perhaps a few men expected to fulfill this dream. More may have assumed that mercenaries would garrison the new territory and deal with any rebellion or attack from the outside, although just like Alexander, few had had much leisure to think in detail of the future. All were consumed by the euphoria of the sheer scale of what they had achieved. They had shown their superiority in battle and in sieges, and this was unlikely to change. Yet there were simply not the number of soldiers to hold down the newfound emperor solely by force, even if all the troops were willing to devote their lives to the task. Alexander was a king of the Macedonians, but they now represented a small minority of the peoples who had submitted to his rule, and Macedonia itself, even after its expansion by Philip, was a small part of the territory he controlled. Philip, and after him Alexander, had become Archon of Thessaly and leader of the alliance of Greek cities, as well as a king of their own people. More recently, Alexander was acknowledged as Pharaoh in Egypt, king in Babylon, and had proclaimed himself Lord of Asia, and these represented far more drastic additions to his power and responsibilities as the ruler of peoples with very different cultures and political traditions. Inevitably, this produced a degree of tension between upholding his relationship with his own people, the Macedonians, and to the slightly lesser extent, Greeks and others who had triumphed under his leadership, at the same time satisfying the expectations of his conquered subjects. at least on the extent of discouraging them from rebellion. From the start, there were fundamental questions about just what it meant to be Lord or King of Asia. No easy or obvious answers. Becoming an Achaemenid was never really practical, since it would be equally abhorrent to his own army after fighting their war of vengeance against the Persian barbarians, as well as to the Persians, who could not have accepted the invader as chosen by Ahura Mazda. There is no sign that Alexander even toyed with this idea, and the burning of Persepolis confirmed that that was not a path he had chosen to take, although he could copy aspects of the Persian government whenever it felt practical. Before the Persians, the Medes, the Babylonians, and the others had ruled empires over much the same area, so there were memories of the other kings of Asia, which helped prepare the way for a new one, established by conquest like all the predecessors. Like the Persians, the successful rulers had delegated a lot of power to the regions, allowing their communities, their religion, custom and laws in return for obedience and, of course, paying taxes. Greeks and, as far as we can tell, Macedonians despised Easterners as barbarians, inferior in every way, and treating them and their traditions with respect did not come naturally to most. One additional reason for appointing Persians and locals to their satraps was that very few of Alexander's own men spoke any Asian language or showed the slightest enthusiasm to learn it. So you can see there are some serious issues that we're going to have to deal with as he prepares to move on. So we'll pick up next time and do a little more of this discussion about pragmatic details before he starts marching off to the east. Now the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch. Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy. History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond. In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. Some additional sources for the sections on Alexander rules would include, of course, Arians, The Campaigns of Alexander. In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great by Michael Wood. The Wars of Alexander the Great by Haeckel, and The Story of Alexander's Empire by Mahaffey. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.